All right. Got a couple of more people just coming in at the end. That's okay. We will kick this off. My name is Damien Edwards. I'm a program manager on the ASP.NET team at Microsoft in Redmond. So great to see so many people here to hear about ASP.NET and HTML5 and how we can use these two things together. You'll have to excuse my voice. I flew directly here from Norway, where I gave three talks last week in Norway while I had a chest cold. And so now my voice is slowly on recovery. If you want to see how bad it got, you can go to the NDC website and watch my last talk I gave last week, and you'll see how I had to resort to using Word to type out my talk and then get it to speak it for me and then grumble through the rest of it. So my voice is a lot better than it was at the end of last week. It's still, hopefully by Thursday this week when I give my next two talks, my voice will be that little bit better again. So I do apologize. So HTML5 for ASP.NET 4.0 and 4.5. How many people have played around with HTML5 already? Great. HTML5 is a bit of a loaded term. You know, we use it to talk about so many different things that it's almost lost any meaning. It just sort of is now synonymous for anything modern that you would want to do in a web application. And any browser version greater than 10 is pretty much HTML5. So, you know, why did this happen? Why have we seen this big increase in interest in HTML5 in the last couple of years? Well, web development got pretty sucky there for a while. During the browser wars, and you know, a little bit after that, we as web developers would spend an awful lot of our time battling with the discrepancies between different browsers. I mean, when we tried to do something at all advanced, and even when we weren't trying to do things that were advanced, you know, sometimes we'd want a box on the left-hand side of the screen, we'd have to implement that multiple times in order to get it to work in multiple browsers. So HTML5 is really about a new web standard. It's about moving the web forward, getting to a position where the vast majority of people agree on how these things are actually supposed to work. And then after a certain amount of time, when most of our customers have HTML5 capable browsers, the promise is that our web development will get a lot easier. We'll be able to implement things once with the same markup, the same JavaScript, the same CSS, and have a consistent experience across desktop devices, mobile devices and tablets, and different browsers without us having to do as much work. Now, we're not there yet. We still have a while to go, but HTML5 is here, and we can start exploiting and using some of the features in HTML5 to really improve the experience of our applications and also to improve the maintainability of applications for us as developers, as we're going to see. So HTML5 is huge. Like, the term covers a lot of different technologies. You're not supposed to be able to read everything on this slide. It's just meant to show that there's a lot of tags, there's a lot of APIs, there's a lot of new CSS features, and we can't possibly cover all those in the next 55 minutes. And so I'm going to give you a bite-sized chunk of some things that the ASP.NET team has incorporated into ASP.NET 4.5 and into the templates and into the tooling, to things that we thought that were really, really important and really useful. And then I'll try and give a passing mention to a few other things that you might want to check out as well. But then please leave knowing that there's probably 80% of HTML5 that I didn't even get a chance to cover. So this really is just a beginning. And then from here on, it's your job to go back and look at what you've learned today and then research a little bit more about what else can I do with HTML5. Just on that point about devices again, we really have to thank the mobile industry for really kick-starting the web again a few years ago. You know, before the advent of the iPhone, you know, people had sort of got a little bit blasé about web standards and where the web was going. And it wasn't really until Google came out with Chrome and Apple came out with the iPhone with its fantastic mobile browser that people really sat up and took notice about what really is possible when you have decent HTML5 APIs and standards available to you in devices and desktops. So here we are a few years later, and I think the web is in a much better place as a result of that. So HTML5, when we look at the markup, promises to give us three things in the scope of app developers, which I think is really useful. Smaller, simpler, and semantic. So we have new tags available to us that lets us build the foundation of our web pages, the markup, the actual angle brackets, such that there's less of it, it's simpler to understand, and that it has more meaning. so that we're not reusing the same tags and names over and over again for different purposes, which makes it harder to understand and more difficult for us as developers to maintain those applications. So here's an example of this. This is some code that's being used to implement a very popular feature, which is rounded corners. Although now that we're all going metro, this is kind of less useful. But before we were going metro, everyone wanted to do rounded corners and gradients. And HTML5 is really good for those two things. So on the left-hand side was a typical implementation of how you might do rounded corners before these HTML5 extensions. There's about 37 lines of CSS and markup there. And on the right-hand side is how you do that in HTML5 with 8 lines, because there's a native feature to support border radius in CSS. So that's a very crude example of how we can really simplify our application code to get a desired effect. Here's a similar one. On the left-hand side, my font doesn't seem to work very well there. On the left-hand side, we have, this is trying to implement a placeholder. So if you have a form field, and inside the form field, like a text box, you want to have some text that gives the user a hint about what they're supposed to type in there. And then when they click inside the text box, you want that to go away so that they can type it in what they want to actually put in there. So on the left-hand side is an implementation of this using raw JavaScript before HTML5. And then on the right-hand side is how you would do this in HTML5 because it's a natively supported feature. And on the left-hand side, we sort of have 5 paths of code execution that could possibly be followed in this code. So that's sort of how complex the code is. And on the right-hand side, obviously, there's only one because it only ever does a placeholder, and that's all it ever does. So again, another example of how we can simplify our code. Here's another one. So here's some markup. We can see at the top here that we've got mixed use of the element div. Now, div is just a throwaway element. We just use it for creating structure. But it has no semantic meaning. So here I'm using it to represent a header section, but I'm then immediately using it also to represent a navigation section. And the only way that I'm differentiating between those two is in one case I'm using the class attribute, and the other case I'm using the ID attribute. So here we see that I have to make a context switch as a developer to understand, well, hang on, this one is a header because it has this other information, and this one is a navigation element because it has this other information. Down the middle, you can see that I've got this div class equals page body, and then div class equals post, and then I've got some content, and then I've got some ads. Now, that div class equals page body isn't particularly portable. So, I mean, the fact that it says class page body pretty much suggests that it only belongs in that place in the document. And if I wanted to take that markup and use it somewhere else because that's a common structure, that would be difficult for me to do. I'd have to do some extra work. Because perhaps I want to put it in another part of a page, in a different page, where it isn't the page body. It's something else, but that structure is useful. Again, these are very simplified scenarios, but you can understand how these explode out into things that are a little more complicated. And then underneath that, with this ads section, I have content immediately after the useful content of the page. So I have some content, which is my actual meat of this page. And then after that, I have ads, which really have nothing to do with the content. They're not related to it, but I've put them there because that was the only way I knew how to get them next to there in the markup, and then I was going to go and style those. But semantically, they're not related to that content at all. So this is how we would change that using HTML5 elements that are now available to us. So you can see that the top div and the top two divs got changed to a header element and a nav element. So now we have first-classed elements that are available to us to represent semantic meaning in our document. So I can have a header, which can either be the header for the page, or if it's embedded inside of another element like a section, it could be the header of that section. And then inside the header, I have a nav element, which is very clearly defines that what's inside this element is to do with navigation on this page. Further down, I've now made that area more portable because rather than using div with a class of page body, I have a section. And then inside the section is an article. Again, the meat of my page in this case is an article. And so we have nice semantic meaning around what these tags mean. And I could very easily pick that section up and place it somewhere else because it's not tied to the page in any other way via way of that class that we saw before. And then finally, the ad that we have here, rather than being just another div inside that article, is actually marked up as an aside. So aside means that, hey, yes, this is the main content of this section, but here's something that's not related, but is being laid out inside this section in the page. Perfect use for putting ads inside an aside element. So again, this markup is much, much easier for you to understand as a developer, and there are a lot more of these elements available to you in order to sort of richly build up your HTML, which, let's face it, is really the foundation and the structure of your web page. And we'll see how the ASP.NET team has used these a little bit later on in our new templates and in some of our new control updates. So that's all the slides. We're going to do no more slides. It's all demos now. I really don't like PowerPoint. I much prefer to code. Who likes coding more than PowerPoint? In fact, I think this is one of my only talks where I actually have slides. Now, I have to give kudos. Those slides aren't mine. The slides were made by another developer on the ASP.NET team, by Matthew Osborne, who's given this talk before. So let's have a look at what we have here. We have Visual Studio 2012 RC, and I have a sample application here that's been put together to show off a couple of things. Let's just run it up so we can see it. It's a podcast application. So it's basically a website that someone who owns a podcast has built, and you can see as I scroll down, I've got links to all the various episodes that are available with a little bit of information about each one. And then on the homepage, I've featured the most recent episode, episode 10, at the top of the page that we can see. So we're going to go through some steps now to enhance this website with HTML5 to make the experience a little bit nicer for people who have used it. So let's go and look at the markup, first of all. I'm going to look at my layout.cshtml, so I'm going to go to my shared folder in views. This is an MVC application, for those who have realized. And the first thing we have to know about HTML5 is that it uses a different doc type. So currently, this doc type is set to HTML 4.01 strict, which was the version of HTML before XHTML. But we don't need that anymore. I mean, it's a really long, complicated doc type in here, which really isn't very useful to me because it doesn't actually do anything except tell the browser that, hey, I want you to render in standards mode. So all I'm going to do is remove all that stuff. That's the doc type for HTML5. It's just bang, doc type HTML. You don't have to worry about specifying a DTD anymore. If it's just HTML, we assume that you mean HTML5, which is great. So that's the first step. Second step I'm going to do is, and scroll down here, you can see I have a div with an ID of a header and div with an ID of footer. And we saw before that we have new tags that replace those concepts, so let's use them. We've got a header here. Let's come down to footer. We've got footer here. Okay, let's go to our index now. And I'm going to look for that featured section. So this is the index page, which is the home page for that main controller. So that's the one that was showing the episode 10 in blue and then all the episodes underneath. We have that featured div, which was being used to show that big blue episode 10. And I'm going to change that div to a section because it was a logical section on the page. It was distinct from the section underneath it and the section above it, which was a heading and then other content. So I'm going to mark it as a section. Also, you'll note that inside this section, we have two heading tags immediately after each other. We have an H1 and then an H2, which semantically is very good. But we could group those a little bit better to show that those two headings are actually related. And so we can use the new HGroup tag to do that. I'm just going to surround them with that. And so now we have an HGroup with our two headings inside. Now, a lot of these tags won't change visually how the document looks in the browser, and that's okay. The purpose of semantic tags isn't necessarily to give different UI to the elements. It's to give better structure to the elements in the markup. And if you think about how you build your application up from there, we would now go and add CSS and we would add JavaScript to enhance those elements to make them look different and to make them behave differently with JavaScript. And if we use strongly typed elements like this, it's much easier to attach to those from CSS. We don't have to use classes, we don't have to use IDs if we don't need to. And then from JavaScript, it's much easier to select them with things like jQuery. Again, we don't have to maintain, we don't suffer from this classitis where everything has a class because it's the only way we can make it two divs do different things is by adding different classes to it. Okay, so let's have a look at what this looks like now. As you can see, nothing really looks different because all I did was change some semantic tags. But I'm going to flip down to IE7. Whoops, and we see things start to look a little bit bad now that I'm using IE7. So let's have a look at why that's happened. I'm going to pin this down in the bottom. These are my developer tools. I hit F12 to bring those up. I'm going to right mouse. I'm going to choose this little picker over here and click this. And we can see that something doesn't look quite right down here. So in the DOM tree for my document here, you can see that the header tag really doesn't look like it's supposed to. And if we look at the footer tag, you can see that that doesn't look very good either. So rather than these elements being nested inside the header tag, I've sort of got this element out on its own, which is self-closed, and then I have no idea what this is. It's like slash header and then another slash. And so this is a problem with IE versions less than 9, whereby if you use element names that they doesn't natively support, you get these empty DOM nodes where it doesn't know what to do with them. So rather than putting them in the DOM when it parses them and just saying, hey, I don't know what this is, I'll treat it as a block element, it says, I don't know what this is, and then just moves on. Which isn't really great if we're trying to use HTML5 elements, because HTML5 is supposed to be backwards compatible when doing this type of thing. So how can we fix that? Well, luckily it's fairly easy to fix, and we do this in the templates. Let me show you how we do this. So we've already got the Modernizer script in here. So Modernizer is a library developed by a number of awesome guys. Some of them work for Google and Chrome. Some of them work for some other groups. And it's a polyfill. It's a library that we call a polyfill. It sort of fills in the gaps where a browser doesn't support particular things that perhaps it should. So in the case of Modernizer, it's a very small polyfill for HTML5 elements like this, and it's also a library for helping detect when a browser supports something or doesn't, which we'll use a little bit later on. So I already have Modernizer in my solution, so all I need to do is add it to my layout.cshtml. So I'm going to come up to the head here, and immediately before any of this other JavaScript and before any of this CSS, I'm going to add a link to Modernizer. It's Modernizer dash 2.5.3. Okay, so let's come back here now. Let's hit F5. And we'll see that immediately we're now getting our styling back. And if we look in F12 again and have a look at the difference, let's select this. You can see that those header tags are being properly represented now. And so what Modernizer did, just so you know, is that it turns out to be a bit of a hack in the IE parser less than version 9 that you can do, which is if you call document.createElement and you pass in a tag that IE doesn't otherwise understand, suddenly the parser will decide that it understands it. And so then any header in the page, if you say document.createElementHeader, anytime it then encounters a header, it'll go, oh, I know what that is, and it'll shove it in the DOM. And so that's why that ends up working. So isn't it great that we have these hacks to get around these shortcomings in older browsers? And then obviously in your CSS, you also have to go and add some style, because by default that tag will be an inline tag. I've already done that, so these are already display block, which is why they're all showing up as block elements, which is cool. Okay, let's move on to the next thing. So now that we've got some HTML5 elements in here, let's look at some HTML5 elements that actually add a little bit of functionality. So this is a podcast site, so it sounds like it would probably be a good candidate for using one of the new media elements, in this case the audio element. So I'm going to go to my index page where I'm showing off the current featured episode. And above the download link, I'd like to put in an inline media player so that people can just play the episode right there. So I'm going to add the audio tag. And I'm going to use a snippet. We actually have a nice new snippet for doing this, like so. And I actually have, for the purposes of demo, an MP3 file up here. There it is. It's in audio. So I'm going to say audio/episode.mp3. Now, you'll note that the audio tag can take multiple source elements. So this is to support the situation where perhaps the browsers don't all support the same file format. Because even though we have these elements for audio and video, and you can do pretty much the same thing for video here, not all browsers agree on what the default audio format should be. And so generally, most people support MP3, so it's pretty safe to put that there. But you might be using a more exotic file format like OGG as your primary format, and you might want to put that first, and then fall back to a different format for those browsers that don't support it. In this case, I only have an MP3 file, so I'm just going to delete that other one. So let's go back now that I have that and run this up again. Okay, so I'm still, let's minimize this down. So you now see that IE has rendered a native, very metro looking, I might say, audio player. And if I click play on here,
15 minus 20 seconds.
We do indeed have a podcast that's being played by default, which is great. So I didn't have to do any work. I have an inline audio tag. I can go home for the weekend, and my boss is really happy. That's fantastic. So what happens, though, if the browser doesn't support audio? Okay, well, let's go back into our Twilight Zone where we're using old versions of IE, and I'll just flip into IE10 compat mode. Okay, so obviously it just doesn't show up. Well, that's good. I mean, it doesn't crash, and it doesn't show something that we don't want it to show. It just doesn't show up at all. But that's actually kind of good that it works that way. But what if I want to show a message? Well, that's kind of easy. All I have to do is come in here and say, you are using a browser that doesn't support playback, audio playback via HTML5. Sorry, you. There we go. So now we get this message. You are using a browser that doesn't support audio playback via HTML5. Very, very easy to do. We now have a message. Now, I can put anything inside there. It wouldn't just have to be text. So you could choose to use another library, another one of these polyfill libraries that adds this capability back in, perhaps using something like Silverlight or Flash. And I could actually put that content inside there. So there's one that's quite popular called MediaElement.js that'll do that for you. So if you're interested in using that, you can just search that, and it's very, very easy to use inside there. In my case, I don't want to show that at all to most people when they're looking at it. I kind of like the fact that the text is in there in the document. So if a search engine is searching it, they'll see that text. Or if a screen reader is reading it, that text would get read out. But for people who are just using a browser and looking at the screen with their eyes, I don't really want them to see that text. So let's add some JavaScript now that hides that element if the browser doesn't support audio. So I mentioned that Modernizer has this capability of detecting whether a browser supports certain HTML5 features or not. So let's exploit that. I'm going to go into my demo.js. So this JavaScript file has already been referenced by the document. I'm just going to add a jQuery document on load handler here. So this script will run once the document has finished loading. And I'm going to say if not modernizer.audio. So it's very, very simple test. All I have to say is modernizer, which is the root level object that the library adds. And then off that, it creates all these properties that represent true or false whether the browser supports that feature or not. So I can just say if not modernizer.audio, then go ahead and select all the audio tags in the document using jQuery and then just hide them. Simple as that. So let's come back. Run this up again. So I'm in IE10 mode at the moment, so let's switch back to IE7. And so now you'll see that that element is no longer there. If I go into the DOM tree, though, you see the audio source is, in fact, in the DOM tree. You can still see that you were using a browser that doesn't support audio playback is in the DOM. I'm just not showing it to the user now because I don't want them to see that message. So great way to use Modernizer to just dynamically change your website depending on what that browser supports. Now, this is a combination of two techniques we call progressive enhancement and graceful degradation. So progressive enhancement is the concept of starting with a foundation base, which has a broad support, and then you build on features on top of that. Graceful degradation is kind of the opposite, where if you have a rich feature that you know isn't supported by certain clients, then you can ensure that your application gracefully degrades back to an experience that is at least usable. Okay, so that's kind of a combination of both of those things that we've just seen there. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit now and look at a totally different feature of HTML5, which is application caching. So at the moment, of course, this is a web application. And so if I shut down the web server, the web application no longer works, of course, because the browser is making requests to the server, and if the server isn't there, the application stops working. Wouldn't it be great if HTML5 had a feature that would let my application keep running even when the server wasn't available in some type of offline mode? Well, it does. So what we can do is we have to go to our layout page. I'm going to add a little bit of code to my head here. I'm going to use a snippet for this. There's a manifest attribute on my HTML that I can pass in a URL to that is, in this case, an action to a controller in my MVC application that's going to return some type of manifest, some document that explains to the application what should be cached. And, of course, I've put it in the wrong place. It should be on the HTML tag, not the head tag, which is why VS was screaming at me. Okay. So now that I have that, let's go and actually add this controller because I don't have that controller yet. So I'm just going to add a class. I'm going to choose the MVC controller class template. I'm going to call it cache manifest controller. Okay, I don't need any of that. Let's go back to my snippets and I'm going to grab my cache manifest here. Okay, so what does this do? I'm just going to import the string builder. So I just have a string builder. I set the response content type to text/cache.manifest, so it's a different MIME type. I new up a string builder, and then I just go through and append a bunch of lines to this manifest, which the browsers are going to interpret as instructions as to which resources can be cached. So you can see here that I've given the resource a unique string, which in this case is just a GUID that I newed up a little earlier up here. It's a static GUID on the controller. And then I'm telling it can go ahead and cache the CSS, that audio file that we saw, and then all these links. So the home link, which will just be slash, and then all the links to the individual episodes. So basically, I'm telling it to cache my entire website, which might be fine depending on the type of site you have. Or you could be a little more advanced, and you could say, well, I want to have a distinct offline mode, and so I only want to cache these elements, and then I want some special offline JavaScript that gets run when I'm in offline mode that sort of runs at a reduced feature set or something, which you could absolutely do if you wanted to. So now that I've done that, let's also go back to my index here, and I'm going to add a little note to the page that tells whether the site supports running in offline or not. So let's come over here. Grab this offline note, and actually I want to put that in my layout, the header. Okay, so I've just got an offline note saying this app works offline. And then lastly, I want to write some JavaScript that is going to change that message based on whether the browser supports offline or not. So I'm going to come back to my demo.js, and I'm going to do a very similar thing to what I did before. So I'm going to say if not modernizer, application cache is the name of the feature, then I'm going to go ahead and select that element, which I called offline node, with a hash, and I'm going to set its text to something else. So if you don't support offline, say, this is not supported offline. Okay, let's run that up now. So I'm in IE10 mode, so this app does work offline because I'm using IE10 on Windows 8, and that supports this HTML5 offline cache manifest, which is great. If I switch over to IE7, you can see it says this is not supported offline. Okay, so let's go back to IE10. Let's kill my web server. So here we go. Stop. Gone. Hit refresh. See, the app still works. So the browser is caching this application in the internal application cache, and I can continue to use this app, including playing the audio file, because that was cached as well. And everything is great. If I go back to IE7, you can see I get the spinny wheel of doom, and doesn't work because IE7 didn't support the offline cache. So again, that's kind of cool. So you can see how using Modernizer here, we could, in offline mode, go into some sort of elaborate offline mode. Anyone ever done Silverlight development? Okay, so Silverlight had this offline capability. It was introduced in 3 or something. And you may have done something similar where you run the app in offline mode and then you get status indications when the app comes back online. So you could do a very similar thing here. If you're in offline mode, you could start pinging the server every 60 seconds to see if it's online. And then when it's online again, you could sort of show a message saying the app's online now, and then rehydrate all those features that the user would want to use when the app is online. So kind of a nice thing. Okay. So let's go back to the application, which of course I've stopped. And let's run this up in Firefox. Okay. Now, of course, everything I've shown you there will work in all the modern browsers. You can see here that this app works offline. This website is asking to store data on your computer for offline use. That's kind of nice. Firefox actually asks permission as to whether it should do that. I'm just going to say not now for the moment. I'm going to hit F12 to bring up Firebug. So Firebug, I'm sure all of you have used, is the sort of the browser developer tools upon which all others have been judged. And I've got an extension in here called YSlow. Who's used YSlow before? Okay, a few people. So YSlow is a tool that Yahoo built. A guy called Steve Souders, who sort of wrote the book, literally, two of them, on website performance, on front-end engineering, specifically on how to make your application website feel like it's running faster because it makes less requests and things like that. And so you can run a test with YSlow that'll give you a score about how well your application is doing from a performance point of view, specifically from a front-end performance, not about your database or how much CPU your server's using, but very much about how will the browser perform based on what you're doing? And you can see it's giving me a few failures here because I'm making too many HTTP requests. I currently have 15 external style sheets, which, you know, isn't probably great. It says try combining them into one. That's a great idea. How would I go about and actually combine them into one? Well, there's lots of ways you can do that. Yahoo themselves make a library called the YUI compressor that you can run at build time that'll take a bunch of CSS or JavaScript files and munge them into one. There's one from Microsoft, one of the Microsoft teams called Ajax Min that does a similar thing. And in ASP.NET 4.5, we have an out-of-band component that does this for you at runtime, which we call the ASP.NET optimization. So if I go over to NuGet, I can quickly show you where this lives. So on NuGet.org, assuming the web's up, if I search for system.web.optimization, obviously I get nothing because we recently changed the name of it. So this used to be called System Web Optimization in beta, and now in RC it's called microsoft.aspnet.web.optimization to aid in discoverability. Because if everything starts with microsoft.aspnet, the idea is that it'll be easier for you to find. So here it is, microsoft.aspnet.web.optimization. In 4.5, this is used by default in our templates, which we'll have a look at in a little moment. But let me show you what this application would look like, how I would have to change it to utilize optimization. So at the moment, if we go back to my layout page, you can see that the content, I'm just pulling in JavaScript, CSS. I'm pulling in this jQueryUI.allCSS, which looks like one CSS file, but YSlow told us that actually I had 15 CSS files, so that's kind of odd. But if we drill into this and look at this file, you can see that it actually imports two other files, and that file imports all the world. So you know, sometimes you're not always aware of how many CSS files you're actually being pulled in based on what you're referencing in your HTML. So let's open a pre-canned version of this that has all this done so that we don't have to sit through me doing it. Not there. Let's come up here. Okay, this one. Please don't take a few minutes. That would be bad. There we go. Okay. So let's have a look at what we've changed this time around. So, nothing. Ha ha ha. Demo failure. So let's have a look at this one. Okay, I think I've stuffed something up there, so let's not do that. I will show you this in the very next section, because I can, because we're about to move on to 4.5, and all this is turned on by default in 4.5. So let's do that right now. Let me come out of full screen mode. Let's just start a new 4.5 application. File, new, project. I'll do .NET Framework 4.5, ASP.NET MVC 4. It's OK. I'll do the internet application. Note that we have a few more templates now for MVC in 4. We have mobile application, which is just jQuery mobile. We have a truly empty template, which really is empty now. And what was called the empty template now is called the basic template, because a lot of people complained that the empty template was, in fact, not empty. And now it is. So let's choose internet application, because that has everything that I want to show you now. So I just showed you where you go and get that optimization from. That optimization package is on NuGet. So great thing about these new templates is that they pre-install a whole bunch of great stuff from NuGet for you. So if you open packages.config, particularly the MVC ones install a lot of stuff from NuGet. So you can see that the MVC runtime itself is actually installed from NuGet. So this application is actually rendering referencing MVC from bin by default, and Web API and a whole bunch of other stuff as well. But the thing I'm really interested in is this line here, which is what I just talked to you about, ASP.NET.Web.Optimization. So how is that set up? Well, it's going to global or ASAX. We can see that on application start, which runs when the first request hits your application, we're going to call into bundleconfig.registerBundles. So the other name that our optimization package goes by is bundling and minification, because that's all it does at the moment. In the future, this optimization package may do other types of optimization, but at the moment, it does CSS and JavaScript bundling, which is when we combine multiple files into one, and minification, where we strip out white space and rewrite your code so that it's much smaller. So register bundles, if I F12 on that to navigate through, what we'll see is it's put me in AppStart. There's a folder over here now called AppStart and a file in there called bundle config. And bundle config, if I go back to full screen mode, we can see just does a whole bunch of stuff to call into the bundling APIs to set up a bunch of bundles. So we have a JavaScript bundle that contains just jQuery. Note that we have this nice wildcard syntax. So because jQuery and a lot of other libraries include the file, the version name in the file name, it makes it a real pain to update because you have to go and find. And you always forget and you spend an hour trying to figure out why it doesn't work. And then you go, oh. So now that using the templates by default, you don't have to worry about that. You just update jQuery from NuGet and everything just continues to work, assuming jQuery didn't break anything, which they never do, so that's fine. So we've got one for jQuery UI, jQuery Validate, which includes both the Validate library itself and the MVC unobtrusive extension, so they get bundled into one file. Modernizer, which we've looked at. The CSS for the website itself, which is just a single file, but obviously we want it minified so that it doesn't take up as much space. And then here's jQuery UI, which is where all those files were coming from before. So rather than pulling in that other jQuery UI file, which then delay imported all the other files, which means we get 15 different requests to the server, I'm just going to go ahead and bundle up the entire jQuery UI theme CSS into a single file. And what this means is at runtime, let's view Solution Explorer. And let's go to our views shared layout again. Look at how this is referenced in the page this time. It's a little bit different. So we can see now, before we had at url.content inside of script tags and link tags, now we have these new helpers. We have styles, which lives in system.web.optimization.style, so it's part of the optimization pack, and scripts, which also lives in system.web.optimization. So I can just say styles.render and then pass in the bundle paths of the bundles I want to render. So if we go back to bundle config, you can see that this first string passed into the constructor of style bundle is the bundle path. That's what I need to tell that helper to render. So /content/CSS, that's here, /content/CSS, and here's the jQuery UI bundle being rendered here. And underneath that modernizer. So let me control F5 and run that up and we'll see what the difference is. Now, by default, this application is set up for debugging support. If we go into the web.config file, we can see that, scroll down, compilation debug equals true. So if I go and look at my CSS tab and drop this down, you can see I'm still getting all of those CSS files individually. So during debug mode, we still give you all the individual files that make up the bundle because it's much easier to debug stuff when it isn't being squished and all the comments and whitespace stripped out and when it's all in the same files that they were on the server. So if I want that to do the actual bundling, I need to change this to false. Okay, debug mode equals false. Come back, hit F5. And this time we'll see, I only have two links now. Isn't that cool? So if we go to view source, and we scroll in a bit on this, or zoom in a bit even, we can see up here, here's my link, content/theme/base/CSS. So that's... obviously, this part here is the folder in your application where these script files, the CSS files exist. The /CSS suffix is an instruction to the optimization system to say, find all the CSS files in this folder and squish them up and combine them. And then it does a really nice thing for me. After that, it renders a query string, V equals, with a big long hash. And what that is a string that represents the contents of all of those files. So if any one of those files changes, that string will change, meaning that the browser sees that as a new URL and it downloads it. So it means you can set a really long cache expiration on these links in your web.config file. You can say system.webserver and go into the right section in IIS and set a long cache duration for your CSS files. And then the browser could cache that for a year if you don't change your CSS in a year. You may have an application where that sort of stuff doesn't change often. But as soon as you do make a change, you don't have to worry about breaking cache because the optimization system will do it for you. So we call that cache busting or cache breaking. So that's kind of nice. Now, incidentally, let's talk a little bit more about 4.5. So I showed you MVC. You got these nice new templates in 4.5. Who hasn't seen these templates before? It's the first time who's seen these. Okay, so a few people haven't seen these, yep. So these look a lot nicer than the templates we used to have, I think. We have an about page and content page. If we look at the markup, again, you'll note that we are indeed using those HTML5 elements. So we have header, and we have section, and we have nav, and those sort of things. So that's kind of nice. If we look at the, go back to the Visual Studio and go back to the source, let's go to content, site.css. We'll note that our CSS is kind of really nicely structured now. So you should be able to scroll, see how it's nicely indented. So you can sort of tell when one CSS rule cascades from another. We've even commented the different sections and stuff now. So we really put a lot of effort into making our templates sort of a real way to kickstart your applications this time around. So even if you don't like how they look, like the colors and whatnot, you should be able to leave the HTML structure and go in and just use CSS to change how the thing looks and then just replace the content with your content. So that's MVC, but we also did all this work for our other frameworks. So if I fire up a new instance and I do file new project, my baby, WebForms, I'm also the program manager for WebForms, you'll note that it's also adding a bunch of stuff via NuGet. So we also get that benefit now of WebForms projects of pre-installing packages from NuGet. And if I run this up, you'll see that it looks identical. It just says WebForms instead of MVC. Like so. So now we have look and feel and feature parity across all three of our frameworks. And if I did web pages, it'd be exactly the same as well. So that's kind of nice. Okay. Now, WebForms is also set up to do bundling. It does do it a little bit differently. I won't dive into that, but if you're a WebForms developer, just open it up, look at the master page, and you'll see the script manager has a bunch of stuff in here set up to sort of do bundling remapping, and you can sort of learn how that works. But rest assured, it's still using the bundling system under the covers, and you'll still get the benefits of reducing those files down to one or two instead of the 15 that we saw before. So that's the templates. One of the other nice things about the templates, while I'm here, that I can show you, let me run this up again, is we implemented something called responsive design. Who's heard of responsive design? Okay, just a smattering of people. So note that the page looks pretty good here, but obviously mobile devices are really, really big now, as I mentioned before, whether they be phones or tablets. And they don't always have a screen as big as my laptop here, obviously. So let me fire up a different browser. I'm going to fire up Opera Mobile Emulator. And let's pick something like the Nokia N9, because it's basically the Nokia Lumia 900. Now let me grab this URL, paste it in here. And what we should see is that, hey, you know, it actually kind of looks okay. So we're actually utilizing CSS media queries, which is a feature of CSS 3, part of HTML5, that lets us adapt how the page looks based on how big the device is that is looking at it. So you can see some things that have changed here. We've moved these menus to be underneath the logo because obviously they wouldn't make sense side by side. And then everything else just kind of really flows. We sort of we hid the images here as part of the bullets because there really wasn't enough room for those in the mobile design. And other than that, all the content is there. It's perfectly readable. And we kind of get that benefit that everyone can read it. Now, if I come back to IE and I bring this out of maximization, as I resize this, you can actually watch this happen in real time. So you can see it's getting smaller, and then as I get to about there, to about 600 to 700 pixels wide, it jumps. So that's sort of the threshold where we detect you're in a mobile mode, and we start laying stuff out differently. So you saw that the images disappeared, and the logo position changed. So again, you can have a look at how we did that, because it's inside the templates in the CSS folder. So again, hopefully that's a useful thing that's in the templates now rather than just something that you go file new and then delete everything, which is what we were trying to get rid of, away from. Okay, so let's go back and look at Visual Studio for a moment, look at some of the features that we've introduced in Visual Studio to make it a little bit better. I'm going to go to my master page. Now, up here on the toolbar, some of you might have noticed, this has been here for a while. This is the target schema for HTML validation select box. It's part of the HTML editing toolbar. Here it is, HTML source editing, which is on by default. It was there in 2010 and 2008 as well. But it was always set to XHTML 1.0 transitional, and most people never changed it. Now they're in the brave new world of HTML5. We sort of updated this a bit. So you'll note it's currently set to HTML5 and it says doc type at the beginning of it. So I'm going to come in here. I'm going to delete this doc type. Still says doc type HTML5. Well, that's cool. I'm going to come in here and look at, I have some snippets for other doc types. So I'm going to use this one. So this is the XHTML 1.0 strict doc type, and you can see that it changed to the closest matching schema that it has to match this doc type. In this case, XHTML 1.1. Now, they're all still available, so if you want to manually select it, you can. But by default, it's just going to use the doc type. So again, I can come back in here. Let me zoom out. Delete all that other guff, and then wait, and it goes back to HTML5. And what this affects, incidentally, is your IntelliSense. So all the things that show up inside this list. So header will show up because I'm HTML5. If it was XHTML, it wouldn't. And also the validation. So you'll get green squigglies under things it doesn't understand. So that's the first thing that we've done. You might have noticed something that happened before when I was doing some changes in the first demo. So in this case, if I wanted to change this div element to something else, I can now just highlight the div and start typing. And you'll note that it also types over the end tag that matches the first tag. And that works the other way as well. So I could go to the bottom and change that back to a div, and it redoes the top. Really, really nice feature, that one. I use that one all the time. Okay. Let's look at some new tags. So in WebForms 4.5, we've added support to the existing text box control to support a lot of the new types that are supported by HTML5. So I'm just going to add a new page in here. WebForm using master page. Let's get rid of these. I don't need those ones. So I'm going to add a text box. And now in text mode, we'll see that we have a lot more values available in this enumeration. Date, time, email, month, multi-line, number, password, etc., etc. So let's try date, time, see what that actually does. Zoom out of that. Oops, not that one. Okay, so let's run this up. I'll put a label on here so we can... we don't need a label. Let's just run that up. So not much changes. At the moment, I'm in IE10, and note, it just looks like a text box. Nothing is different. If we go view source and have a look at what's in the HTML. Where's my text box? Where's my text box? Find the text box. There it is. You can see type has been set to date time. Well, that's great, but IE hasn't really done anything with it. So let's go over to a browser I know that does support these things actually really nicely. So this is Opera. And so far, it's the only browser that has committed to implementing native pickers for date time. So you can see here that because this is a date time text box, I've got a native picker with a date element, and I can sort of zoom through the months and choose my year and zoom to today and change the time as well, which is kind of nice. And there's more of these as well. You saw in this list here, there's email, there's color. I think Opera even supports the color picker, so if I F5, yep, I get a nice color picker in here, uses the system color picker, which is kind of cool. But poor old IE, I shouldn't say that. Awesome IE. Now, IE does actually support some of these, and if you go to the IE test drive site in IE10, they have some fantastic demos about the new HTML5 forms support they do have, including validation as well. It's a lot more advanced, though, and a lot of the browsers still don't support that stuff, so I'm just showing you the basic stuff for now. But this is an interesting segue. So, okay, datetime is fantastic. And indeed, if we go and look at a different MVC application, so let's go and have a look at one I created earlier. Let's come up here. Let's come here, MVC 4. Let's open this one. MVC 4, by default, with its field template generation, its HTML helpers that it uses, will actually use the appropriate input types. So I have a customer controller here. I have a very simple model, customer. Let me show you that briefly. So if I come to models, here's my customer model. It's decorated with some data annotations. So this is a date time. And what we'll see is when I say create new, an F12 in here, come across, and you'll note that type equals date time. So MVC by default now in MVC 4 will choose the appropriate text type based on the model information that it has available to it. But of course, still, I don't really get any great UI for that. So let's have a look at how we could polyfill a nice date picker UI back into my date of birth. So I happen to know that jQuery UI has a fairly nice date picker. So wouldn't it be cool if I could use the native date picker in browsers that support a native date picker and jQuery UI's date picker for the rest of the world? So let's do that. So we saw before how we could use Modernizer to detect if a browser supports specific things or not. So I'm going to come into my layout page. I'm going to go right down to the bottom. And underneath this bottom script section, I'm going to paste in a block of JavaScript. This one here. Oops. Oh, not that one. Let's try that again. Control C. Okay. So what does this do? So I've imported another library here called YepNope. YepNope is a conditional script loader made by the people who make Modernizer. So YepNope, you can see it over here in my scripts folder. I installed it via NuGet, very easy to do. And what YepNope lets you do is conditionally load JavaScript or other resources, CSS, if a certain test condition succeeds or fails. So this is perfect for what we're about to do, because we want to conditionally add more functionality to the page, but only if the page doesn't, or the browser doesn't natively support that functionality. So I call YepNope and I pass into it an object. The first property on that object is the test. What is the Boolean expression to test to see if it's true or false? In this case, it's modernizer.dateTime. Does the browser support dateTime elements? Nope, it doesn't. Go ahead and load this URL. So I've just got a razor block inside here, scripts.url, so I can resolve the jQuery UI bundle at runtime. So that's going to give me jQuery UI dynamically loaded into the page if the page doesn't support dateTime natively. Then once that's finished, so complete is a callback that'll get invoked when that script is finished downloading, go ahead and check again, does the browser support dateTime? And if it doesn't, not here. Go ahead and use jQuery UI to find all of the dateTime elements on the page and then invoke the date picker helper or widget on that. And that's all I had to do. So if I go back to the page now, I think it was this one, I hit F5. And I come in here, lo and behold, I now have a jQuery UI date picker. So I can click in here. Fantastic. If I go back to Opera and I take the URL with me, let's put that in here. You'll note that Opera is still getting its native date picker. And Opera wouldn't have downloaded jQuery UI, so you don't get that unnecessary resource hit on the browser because it was going to have no need for it in this sample. So again, a really nice way that we can use Modernizer with to conditionally find HTML5 support if it's there, and if it is, pull in extra resources to polyfill or backfill that support into browsers that don't yet support it. Really, really cool stuff. So let's go back to Visual Studio and look at some other features that might be of interest to you. So we saw how the HTML editor has some new features like the type over support. Another one that I really like is quote type over. So here I can say text ECMAScript. I've got my cursor inside just before the double quote, and if I type double quote again, it recognizes that it's already there and just takes me to the next line, next thing. It's a really, really minor thing, but oh my God, so useful. When you're in there in the zone, you're just typing stuff out. The number of times I've accidentally entered double quotes twice because of the lack of this sort of stuff is a lot, and now I don't have to worry about it. So that's kind of cool. Yay! HTML rules. So let's go to CSS and look at some of the improvements in the CSS editor. So first of all, the CSS editor has been completely rewritten for Visual Studio 2012. Literally everything else was thrown out and we started again from scratch. So immediately you might notice that we now have collapsible sections for our style rules, which is kind of nice. I believe it also supports regions. Let me try that out. So I'm going to select this and say Control C. We also support commenting in CSS files now. We never supported that before, if you can believe it. So let me say end region. And we'll note now that we have a region in my CSS file as well, which is kind of nice. For those people who like regions. I know a lot of people hate regions and it's sort of this love-hate thing going on, but they are kind of useful for certain things. Okay, so that's kind of nice. Let's scroll down. Note how these rules are indented underneath this rule because logically A colon hover is always going to be applied after A. I mean, it cascades from A. This is the whole point of cascading style sheets. So a lot of people organize their CSS like this. They indent their rules. Previously, what would happen is if you formatted this document in Visual Studio, we would destroy all that beautiful indenting. And so most people just try to religiously avoid hitting format accidentally. And then someone invariably on the team would check it in after formatting. You go, no! Roll back! And so now I can say A .foo, so this is a descendant class selector. Space is descendant, dot is a class. Open, close, and look at that. It automatically indented it for me because it knows that it's inside this other rule. Very, very nice. And if I was to invoke formatting, obviously, it also knows that. So it does it automatically while you type, and it also does it when doing formatting, which is kind of nice as well. Okay. Let's see if I can remember all the other CSS features because there's a lot of them. Okay, we did commenting. We did, oh yeah, you might have seen this one. So check this out. Color. Ooh. Is that? Yes, it is. It's a color picker right in my editor. Who said IntelliSense couldn't be visually pleasing? Look at that. So now I can, arrow keys only. I just went down and now I'm going across. So my hands don't have to leave the keyboard. What this is showing me by default is all the colors that are currently being specified in this document. So it scanned the document, found all the colors, and then has shown them in a palette for me so that if you only use three or four colors, you can very, very easily get to them. Then I can hit the down arrow again. Ooh, and I get an even more beautiful color picker. So this is sort of like the Photoshop color picker or the Blend color picker. I can move up and down. Note how it's hex. But there's this opacity slider too. So one of the new features in CSS3 is the ability to have opacity in colors. So as I pull that to see how it changes to RGBA, red, green, blue, alpha. So the alpha channel is another 8-bit channel that you can specify 256 levels of transparency. And you can see the preview is showing me that nice little checker thing that it shows whether it's transparent or not. And if I get all the way back up to the fully opaque, it goes back to hex mode because that's what most people use. Really, really nice. And there's also a color picker, an eyedropper here. So you can come and say, well, I actually like the color of that A right there. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try that again. Color of that A right there. Okay, no, I don't like the color of that A, apparently. I like the color of the white behind the A. I should pick something a little bit bigger, shouldn't I? Let's try this. Let's pick this blue. Ah, there we go. So now I've got that nice blue. Very, very cool. So back when I was doing a lot of web development and doing a lot of CSS, I'd have Photoshop open all day because I'd need it just for the eyedropper tool. So it's really, really nice that this is in the tool. This is actually in Visual Studio now. And you might have noticed before that that also will come up in your HTML if you're using embedded styles. So if you have style in here, because what VS actually does is it uses something called language projection. So this, while this is an HTML document, it's actually a CSS HTML document. So the base language is HTML, and then we sort of project in C# into all the razor expressions, and then inside the style blocks, we project in CSS. So you get all the same CSS features as you would in the standalone CSS editor, because this document actually has four different language services partying on the same file at the same time. The HTML editor is actually one of the most complex editors in Visual Studio because of this. But it means that things like color will work even inside here, which is really, really cool. Okay, let's get rid of that. Go back to my CSS. So the other thing that we added was support for snippets. Let me go back, see if I didn't destroy it. There we go. So we have these great new features in HTML5 to do things like border radius and whatnot. But not all browsers support them in the same way yet. So who's heard of vendor prefixes? Okay, a lot of people. So this is where when a standard is fairly new and still being developed, hasn't been finished yet, our browsers will implement the standard by using a minus some vendor prefix. So for IE, it's minus MS. And note how we get IntelliSense now for all vendor prefixes in the list. Now, by default, it won't show them up because there's a bazillion of them. But if you hit minus, it'll show them all. So we can see Moz, which is all the Mozilla ones, MS, which is the Microsoft ones, O for the Opera ones, and WebKit for all the WebKit ones. So they're all there inside the schema now, so you'll get IntelliSense and validation for them. Then we have the problem that, okay, so something like border radius is great, but all the browsers do it differently in terms of some use prefixes and some don't. So you'll note we have a different icon here. We have this little scissor icon, which is a code snippet. We've had code snippets in HTML, C#, VB, and JavaScript previously, but never in CSS. So if I tab, I now get full expansion of that snippet, and you can see the little replacement zones, so that if I say, well, I want it to be 7 pixels, and hit enter, it replaces them in all those places. And where did I put that border radius? There it is. So just as easy as that, I got border radius across all three without having to remember what they were. Now, snippets is fully extensible. If you hit Control K, Control B, it brings up the code snippets manager, and you can create your own snippets. They're just an XML file that contains a few elements and some code. So if you have things that you do really, really often, I do encourage you to create snippets for them because it really does improve your productivity. Okay, very lastly, in the last few minutes, let's look at JavaScript because I know it's a pain that a lot of people suffer. First thing is we have this underscore references file that's in all the projects now. And by default, Visual Studio is set up to look inside this file and always include IntelliSense for anything that's referenced inside this file. And so if I go and create a new file, add new item JavaScript, and I want to use jQuery, I get IntelliSense for jQuery because it's referenced in that references file. So I don't have to put that references tag in the top of this file anymore. Really, really nice. Incidentally, that is configurable where that is. It's in tools options buried away in the JavaScript editor features. So you can change the name of the file or point it to a common one on a share if you're, you know, all your projects use the same one or something like that, which is kind of cool. So what else is new in JavaScript? Well, we also have code collapsing now. So you can see that we now have collapsible regions for our functions, which is kind of good. Even cooler than that, let's have a function. Let's make this function call something in jQuery. So let's find all the foo elements. Then down here, let's call foo. I put my cursor in here, hit F12, go to definition, it jumps to that one. Then I'm going to come down to here, put my cursor here and hit F12, and it takes me into jQuery. So we now have go to definition support for JavaScript. Really, really useful feature. So again, the JavaScript editor is completely new, built from the ground up, nothing was saved, everything was rewritten. It's based on the IE10 JavaScript engine, so it supports all of the most modern JavaScript standards, including strict mode, property getters and setters, all that wonderful stuff. And it's very, very fast, much faster than the JavaScript editor in Visual Studio 2010, and the IntelliSense is vastly superior. So a lot of the times in 2010 when you would do something in JavaScript and it would just trip up the IntelliSense and say, I don't know what to give you anymore, this one kind of has a fallback feature, whereby if you do something that it doesn't understand, you can note, I'm getting IntelliSense for this because it knows that foo is a function. But let's say that foo takes in a parameter, but I don't invoke it with anything. So it has no idea what p is. How can it possibly know what p is? Because I haven't told it, and I never invoked foo with p. I invoked foo with nothing. So we could get this, IntelliSense was unable to determine an accurate list of completion. So all I did was give you a list of statement completion items that I sort of harvested from the rest of the document. One of these might be right. And so this is actually very useful because a lot of the time this actually will, as you start typing, you might start typing part of it and then it'll very quickly narrow down to the thing that it is that you actually want because you've used it somewhere else in the document. So that's a really, really nice feature of the new IntelliSense for JavaScript as well. Okay, so let's switch back to the slides to finish off. So, if you want to send me any questions or anything, my name is Damien Edwards. You can get me at DamienEdwards.com, Damien Edwards on Twitter, Damien Edwards on GitHub, or Damien Edwards on Coplex, or Damien.Edwards@Microsoft.com. And some other talks that you might be interested in, we've got a dedicated talk on JavaScript by Jonathan Carter, which will talk about the JavaScript features I just showed you in a lot more depth, Dev 308. There's What's New in VS for Web Developers, which will go into a lot more depth into the Visual Studio features that I just showed you. That's with Scott Hunter. ASP.NET for mobile and tablet development, that's me, that's on Thursday. And then you can find me later, I'll be in the Technical Learning Center tomorrow on Wednesday from 10:30 to 1, excuse me, on the Azure booth, if you want to come and ask me any specific questions. Clicker stop working. There we go. Thank you. Please fill in your evals, as always, and have a great tech ed.